Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
The Science of Sports Podcast with Professor Ross Tucker and sports journalist Mike Finch. Coming up in this episode...
Don't drink more, even of a sports drink, to try and compensate for salty sweat. Junk miles happen when you go a little bit too hard, not too easy. Deliberately stop blood flow to a limb... and then do weight training on that limb.
Is there any evidence that it works?
So there actually is. Fatigue is the key, not weight.
So welcome to our second episode of our 2021 season, our season number 3 of the Real Science of Sport podcast. And as usual, I'm here with Professor Ross Tucker. My name is Mike Finch, and I've been a sports journalist for as long as I can possibly remember. And Ross is now an officially... as of last Monday, in the experienced age group, he's now turned 40. He's no longer an under 40-year-old, but still riding like an absolute machine. And I said to Ross when we were riding on Monday that just because he's a bit older, he's probably a little bit wiser, if it's possible to be wiser than you, Ross. But you're a little bit wiser, and that can only be a good thing for our podcast. So I'll take full advantage of that.
I thought so, when you were teeing it up there, you said you've been a sports journalist for as long as Ross has been
Ross
alive.
Ross has been alive.
You were thinking that.
And it's then you backed out of it. There's 10 years difference between you and I. I'm 50, you're 40. And I started working as a sports journalist when I was 18 years of age. So 8 years, give or take. I'm almost as long as you've been alive, I've been a sports journalist. Not quite, but anyway. So what we decided to do in this podcast, I'm sure that a few of you that have been on our Patreon site, if you want to go and support us on Patreon, you can have a look up on Patreon, patreon.com, and look at Science of Sport. You can get on there and become one of our supporters, and there's all sorts of different price brackets you can come into. You can be Ross, you know this really, really well. It's legends are the top guys. There's Olympic hopefuls. What are the different divisions that we've got there?
Olympic legends are the top tier, and then followed by Olympic champions, and then Olympic athletes.
There we go.
So you go on there and you choose. And for those who don't know, it's just essentially a pledge of a donation, a monthly amount that you then give us out of the kindness of your hearts and ears for listening to us waffle about sport once or twice a month. And obviously, we really appreciate it. And then as you were leading into, we will occasionally, like this week, ask you to ask us questions and drive the content.
And that's exactly what we did. And a big thank you to all of our Patreon members, because we got quite a lot of questions. We weren't able to get to them all. We had to kind of pick out the best ones that we can say. I mean, best ones is tricky because there were really lots of good ones. But we picked out a few for this edition, and then potentially in a couple of, well, maybe even next month sometime, we'll do the second half of those Patreon questions.
So we will do all of them.
We will do all of them eventually. Yeah. But a big thank you to all of our Patreon members that sent us those questions, and hopefully we will get a chance to answer some of them today in a way that is satisfactory. There's a bit of a disclaimer on this though, because to some extent some of these questions that have been asked of us today probably require more than just a passing discussion. They are quite intricate, and we will talk about some of those subjects a bit later on, but we will be able to give you some element of an answer. And certainly what it's done is it's given us an opportunity to think about future episodes of the pod and things that we can focus on down the line. So thank you for the ideas, and we really do appreciate those contributions from our Patreon members. I will also have one disclaimer today. Because I'm older than you, Ross, I've left my glasses behind at home, so I might struggle to read some of the questions, but I've made it very big type on my computer at the moment, so I should be able to read them. But if I sound like I'm struggling with some of the questions, I might have to just apologize for that, because it's literally because my aging eyes don't see as well as they used to when I was 40. But let's start off, first of all, Ross, I mean, tell us about this week of yours, being 40 years old. I mean, when we were riding, we had a bit of a celebratory ride on Tuesday night. And here in South Africa, for those of you that live in South Africa, we know we can't go out and have a drink at any of the bars, and we can't buy booze. But we decided what we'll do is we'll go for a ride and celebrate it that way. But does it change that day being, I mean, it's just a number and a day, but when you go from 39 to 40, I didn't battle with it, but you said that you struggled a bit with it.
I didn't need a specific day to make me appreciate that I'm getting older, because every time I do a long ride, I wake up the next morning and I feel like an arthritic old man already. And that was when I was 37. So it didn't. What is odd about it is that you think, you look back, I don't know whether you did this, but when my dad was 40, I was in primary school, almost high school.
Yeah.
And then I look at my situation compared to his then, the equivalent, and I think, wow, am I in the right place? Am I on the right track? So then you have these moments of reflection, which are compounded by moments of aches and pains, and start thinking, actually, the clock is ticking on me here. So anyway, it was semi-depressing in that way, reflectively.
But we had a good time.
We did, and and I mean, it's, I'm not going to complain about getting older, because I'm still healthy and fit and able to do stuff like that. So there's no point being sour about it and say I can't do it as if I was a 24-year-old. But the thing about getting older that I do think is important to accept is that you'll probably never be as good as you were.
Really?
Unless you start something new.
I would disagree with that.
Unless you start something new. But when we go on our rides, and even when I was running, not just been cycling for the last year, but before that, making comparisons to 24-year-old self is actually not a good idea. So you have to start getting out of the habit of doing that.
Yeah.
So if you can do that, and then your expectations change, then you can age with style.
Yeah.
But you have to realize that if your marker for how you're going is your best ever time, that's actually just asking yourself to lose. And we spoke last week about the number one thing for people who are starting out is you have to rig it to win it, remember?
Yeah.
With respect
finish
to...
Finish fast.
Yeah, and set goals that are achievable. Mm. With aging, rigging it to winning it means don't make comparisons to when you're at your peak.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think when I think about performance based on the fact that I run and I cycle, is that as you get older, you're able to do some of the things that you do, you actually do better. I think that I have more endurance, and I think sometimes I have more strength. It takes me a little bit longer to warm up, but once I warm up, I can definitely go, I think, longer and harder. And when I was younger, I had maybe more speed, but I almost look forward to seeing being some of the people that I've seen riding in their 60s and 70s who are doing extraordinary things on a bicycle, let alone runners. You know, here in South Africa, we have the Cape Town Cycle Tour. Breaking a 3 hours for the Cape Town Cycle Tour is like 1% of that ride. And I know there are 70-year-olds who are like riding 302, 301 for that. And you know, they're if you go riding with them on a weekend, on a Sunday, they'll absolutely kill you. So there's a part of me that gets inspired by the fact that we have this perception in our head that as we get older, we're radically slowing down. But I think we can offset that by training smarter, by being smarter.
And differently.
Exactly.
Different activities too.
Absolutely.
And we did a podcast on aging in season one or two. I can't even remember when we did it.
Yeah.
That also comes with that.
but
we did a podcast on aging, and we said there that as you get older, you have to start to pick maybe different activities, different ways to spend your time. And cycling lends itself to getting older with less decline than running does, with a few very rare exceptions. And then you have to start just supplementing. I know you've started doing that. Is it going for a run once a week? So have I, because I realized that on the bike, I was really learning one movement pattern without impact. And I was getting less athletic as a consequence of becoming more cycling fit.
Yeah.
And that's actually not due to age, that's just due to training specificity.
Yeah.
And so anyway, you learn these things, but this is the wisdom that you promised I would acquire.
Yes.
So I look forward to it.
You've only been at 40 for a couple of days and you've already got more wisdom. Look at that.
Well,
why is it going to be when you're 50?
I'm just paraphrasing what you just said. So.
Anyway, so those of you getting a bit older, be inspired by the fact that I think that there's lots of things that you can gain from being older, and certainly I don't think it necessarily means that you're enjoyment of whatever activity you take part in needs to get any less. Right, so let's get to our questions from our Patreon members. And our first question comes from a gentleman by the name of Finn, who said, you have talked about hydration previously, and it was really interesting. My question is, that relates to me. I know it's selfish, he says. I feel like I'm a very salty sweater. I come from Scotland, So it isn't that one would consider a hot climate. When I go to a training camp, I'm a track cyclist at Lanzarote, my preferred destination for warm weather camps. It seems like the amount of salt that lines my face kit in comparison to our athletes is significantly more. And he goes into sort of describe some of those sort of salty, sweaty conditions that he has. But maybe we can talk a little bit about, like, why do we get that salty stuff on our back when we go on long rides or even long runs?
Well, so Finn basically asks then, he says he's a salty sweater.
Yeah.
And he has three questions, effectively. Is it bad? Does it affect performance? And what do I do about it? So in order to answer those three questions, we have to understand, as you've correctly steered us in, is the concept of sweat and salt and why it's there in the first place. The reason you get those white stains, salt stains on the back of the jerseys and so on when you exercise is because when sweat evaporates, the water leaves and the salt stays behind. So that literally is, you could wring it out and season your food with it, right? Don't.
No, don't.
So we sweat to lose heat because the evaporation of sweat from the surface of the skin causes considerable heat loss. Mm-hmm. So on a particularly hot day when you can't evaporate the sweat, it is ineffective, and that's why humidity is as much a challenge as heat. So when Finn goes to his training camps, he's got the double whammy of a hotter, more humid environment than he would normally have encountered in Scotland, potentially, depending on the conditions. So some basics about salt in sweat is our blood plasma contains sodium at a concentration of approximately 140 millimol per liter. Mm-hmm. In the sweat gland, as the sweat is produced, the sodium content in the sweat is the same as in the plasma, 140. But then what happens is, as the sweat moves from the gland where it is produced through the duct to the surface of the skin, some of that sodium is what's called reabsorbed. So in other words, the body says, hang on, we don't want to lose you. We're going to keep most of you behind. The result is that what eventually leaves via the sweat duct and is part of the sweat is what's called hypo, so low, tonic relative to the plasma. So in other words, it's got a lower sodium content than the plasma. Does that make sense so far? And so typically, if you measured the sweat content at your forearm or some surface of the skin, it would be in the range of 40 millimol per liter. Remember, this plasma is 140, primary sweat's 140, but by the time it actually reaches the skin, it's only 40. Mm-hmm. But naturally, there's a spread around that. And so some people are down below 20 millimol per liter, and other people are upwards of 80, touching on 100. Those are the people that you might define as a salty sweater, higher than normal salt concentrations. But still, and this is important, never the same as plasma. So even the saltiest sweater still has a salt content in their sweat that is lower than that of the plasma, right? Now, that's important because theoretically and in concept, you cannot lower your sodium content in your plasma through losing sweat because what is lost is more dilute than what stays behind.
So there's osmotic pressure.
Sort of. It's just in this instance, it's just osmotic comparison. Yeah. What's osmotic pressure is what's driving the fluid exchange between the tissues and between the cells, and that's why the plasma sodium content is so important. Because if that, remember the normal value for sodium plasma content was
140.
Very good. Just checking.
I'm listening.
Just checking that I haven't lost you with all these numbers because I'm worried I give clumsy explanations. So it's 140. If that goes too low and you dilute your plasma, now it hits 130, 125, 120, that becomes a very serious medical condition because you become what's called hypo, again, low, natremic sodium, low sodium. And when that happens, fluid starts moving from the plasma into the tissues, and you get swelling in your brain, and you get fluid in the lungs.
Yeah.
And many people have died during exercise as a consequence of that condition.
It's also known as water intoxication, which I think is a great way to describe it, isn't it?
That is exactly what it is known as. Yeah. However, that is the key point that is going to get us to an answer to Finn's question. Because the question is, does your sodium level in your plasma drop because you added water, or did it because you lost salt? Because you can understand that consequence, that hyponatremia, could be the result of two things. Mm-hmm. You could either be losing the salt or you could be adding water. So here it is. You're in your kitchen. You've got a bowl full of salt and water. And you've got two options. You can either take the salt out and it becomes more diluted. Mm-hmm. Or you can add water and it becomes more diluted. So the key question with respect to understanding fluid balance is which of those is actually happening. Now, way back in 1985... Tim Noakes here in South Africa first identified a case of an athlete with this condition, hyponatremia, by 1991, they had shown pretty conclusively, in my opinion, that that condition was the result of fluid overload or excess and not salt loss. So when you look at a person who comes to a medical tent with a sodium level in the 120s, very sick, they have lost some salt, obviously, because they've been sweating. But the biggest issue is that they've added fluid.
And that's fluid that doesn't obviously contain salt. So it's correct. Just too much water.
And that's water and sports drinks, because sports drinks do not typically contain sodium levels that are the equivalent of our plasma. So Gatorade, Energy, and so on, they are also hypotonic sports drinks. So it doesn't matter how much salt you consume in a sports drink, you are still adding more fluid relative to salt.
And
that's why the argument, and if you look at some of the studies, and there have been dozens of them, where if you take people and you put them, say, in a lab for 2 hours and you make them exercise and you give them either water or a sports drink, their sodium levels decline over time because they're getting fluid. Mm-hmm. In these studies, they typically match your sweat loss with fluid, which you don't need to do, but that's what they do by design. So let's say you're sweating a liter an hour. They're telling you to drink a liter an hour. You either drink a liter an hour of water or a liter an hour of sports drink.
Yeah.
What happens is after 2 hours, your sodium levels are slightly lower when you drank water than sports drink because there's some salt in the sports drink.
Right.
But you're still lower.
So now, why don't sports drinks just have more sodium in them then?
Because it drives thirst. So in actual fact. So and that's been shown as well in studies, is that if you give people unrestricted access to drinks, they will consume more of the sports drink than of water, in large part because of the sodium. Because there are receptors in our mouths that also dictate thirst, trigger thirst mechanisms. And so when you have salt in your diet or salt in your drinks, then you become thirstier. It's the same reason if you eat popcorn, pretzels.
I was going to say, it's like the peanuts at the bar with the beer.
And this is key because our body, the body's regulation of its osmolality is incredibly sensitive, because when that level goes either side of 140 plus or minus 5, it triggers in us behavior change and hormone changes that retain or get rid of sodium.
Sure.
It's like blood pressure. Mm. We have to regulate our blood sodium levels. And so when we lose fluid, not salt, we become hypertonic, hypernatremic, which is too much sodium. Then get super thirsty. We drink water, we dilute it, back to normal. Plus, our bodies kick in different hormones, ADH and aldosterone in different ratios. If we are losing salt, our bodies release this hormone called aldosterone, which then keeps the salt back. So our sodium levels go. So it's a really finely regulated system. And the reason I'm saying all this theoretical stuff is because in answer to Finn's question, salty sweaters do not... There's no evidence that a salty sweater is more vulnerable to loss of salt to cause this condition, hyponatremia. Mm-hmm. There is evidence that they might get lower sodium levels, but that only becomes a risk factor if they overconsume fluids on top of their salty sweat. So the answer to Finn with respect to fluid is don't drink more, even of a sports drink, to try and compensate for salty sweat, because you'll actually accelerate the problem.
Yeah.
And there's some good studies that have shown that when you take and compare people with low sodium and high sodium in their sweat, as long as they drink to thirst, they both end up okay. Right. If you force them to drink too much, the salty sweater might get lower sodium, potentially harmful sodium levels compared to the normal salty sweater.
And he talks specifically about taking salt tabs to offset it.
Salt cap tablets might be a little bit different because there's no fluid implication in terms of what you ingest. It does change your fluid balance inside the body, because all of a sudden your plasma is going to see an increase in sodium concentration. And what's it going to do? It's going to say, that's not desirable. We're going to get rid of sodium. And so what happens is your body then releases anti-diuretic hormones to retain water, so you don't pee as much. Mm-hmm. You'll sweat slightly less of that. You'll sweat slightly more of that sodium out, sorry. So in other words, your body will produce less aldosterone, which means that, remember, your sweat is produced at high concentrations, and then as it moves through the duct, we get some of that salt back.
Yeah.
If you just take a salt capsule, you'll just get less of that back, and you'll end up sweating more of that salt out. So there are studies on men in the army, for instance, in the military, where they'll expose them to heat for like 2 weeks at a time, and they'll change the salt content in their diet. and the amount of salt in their urine and the amount of salt in their sweat just goes up almost exactly in proportion.
The body's regulating itself.
The body is regulating the salt content. So the simple answer to Finn is being a salty sweater is not bad. You fall within a normal spectrum of human sweating salt levels. Doesn't make any difference to performance. Only if you feel that it starts to affect your thirst levels enough to then start to change your perception. So for instance, there are some studies where they've given people large doses of sodium before they exercise, and that helps defend your plasma volume during exercise. And they reckon in those people, they don't perceive the heat the same and they don't have quite the same challenges to defend it during exercise. Now, if that's in Finn's case, he talks about he can't remember if it made a difference, but he seems to recall like his headaches were much less pronounced when taking salt tablets.
Yeah.
If that's him, then go for it. Because the beauty of it being a regulated system is that taking that salt tablet's probably not going to be bad for him.
Yeah.
Up to a point.
Because the body will regulate.
The body will just pee it out and sweat it out more than it would have otherwise. What he should not do is try to overconsume fluid, even salt-containing fluid, to make up for it. Because then he starts to create the actual problem is a fluid overload issue, not a salt loss issue. So...
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's fluid basics 101. It's a complex area. A lot of people take salt tablets and swear by them.
Yeah,
true. Without there being a confirmed in large enough studies mechanism for them. But that's an example of where I would say, look, if it's not harming you and you feel it's beneficial, then why would you change it based on some theory that it can't be proven? I wouldn't.
How would you know if you were taking too many salt tabs or salt caps?
Well, because the consequence would be that your plasma osmolality would go way up.
Yeah.
You'd be thirsty all the time. Yeah. Your blood pressure would start to become... So in actual fact, that's why I say up to a point. Because there would come a point where actually too much salt in the diet is bad. So imagine you start taking 5 salt tablets a day and you're now consuming 20 grams of salt a day. Obviously, that's not healthy.
Yeah.
So for Finn, in his situation, it might be... before particularly long exposures, long training sessions, try it and see. And if you believe that it's working, then go for it. But otherwise, there's really no evidence that you can cheat what is a finely regulated, finely tuned system. You can, however, do serious damage to it if you overdo the fluid intake.
There's a great, I don't know whether you, especially the youngsters who are listening to this podcast will know this, but there's a great character done by Sacha Baron Cohen called Ali G. And there's a great interview that he does with a guy who's a drug expert. And he says to the guy, you know, what he's obviously mocking him about what drugs you should take. And the guy who's the drug expert sort of says, you know, you have a finely tuned, beautiful body. And he goes, oh, thank you very much. And I always remember that because when we talk about the situation, we understand like our bodies, the human body has an amazing capacity for lots of things beyond just this. And the fact that it can regulate itself and listening to it and also understanding your own body, how you perform when you drink certain fluids, you start to understand how your own body works and you become sensitive and more aware of it.
Yeah.
Because it is an amazingly regulatory system in many different ways.
Yeah, and sodium balance, osmolality, is one of the most impressive systems because it triggers thirst so quickly. If that sodium goes 1 millimolar too high or too low, it changes our thirst thresholds.
Yeah, that's incredible.
So one handful of popcorn will make you relatively thirstier.
Yeah.
It will trigger the release of vasopressin to retain a little bit of water. On the other hand, drinking 0.5 liter of water will do the opposite. We'll then say, okay, we've diluted a little bit.
Yeah.
More aldosterone means more sodium retention. And less vasopressin means less water retention. Oh, I need to go to the bathroom now. It really is an amazingly sensitive system that then also changes behavior. And so the key is...
Does it change performance? Do we know if any of those hormones coming into the system based on sodium levels change performance?
No. The performance implication happens when the disturbance or the change to homeostasis is large enough for it to affect your perception of effort. So if you are ingesting so much salt and insufficient water and you don't have access to water, your thirst sensation will start to negatively affect performance.
Right. Yeah.
That's happening at a salt concentration in the mid 140s.
Mm-hmm.
As long as you've got access to fluid, your behavior will correct that situation and you won't see a detrimental effect on performance. But again, we've been in the medical tent at Ironmans, ultramarathons, cycling events, and the fastest athletes finish having lost considerable weight. So they lose between 2 and 5% of their body mass. So a guy who starts at 70 will finish at 65, 66, 67 kilos.
Wow.
Because they sweat for 4 hours, 1 liter an hour, and they only replace 1 liter of that. So they lost 3 liters of fluid. The best predictor of your body's sodium content on the finish line is your weight loss. But your body's not regulating weight, it's regulating sodium. So that's the key. And so most people who finish endurance exercise have high sodium levels in their plasma because they have drunk to thirst. And the body's allowed their sodium levels to trend up because when you finish, you'll replace your... We're delayed drinkers, in effect.
So higher sodium levels at the end of an extended bout of exercise is a normal thing.
Provided they're not too high.
Yeah.
I remember being in the medical tent at the Comrades, which again is a 90K foot race here in South Africa annually. And most of the people in there had high sodium content, plasma sodium. None of them felt like drinking anything because I think 10, 11, 12 hours of running had made them nauseous and maybe too many sweet Cokes and gels and stuff on the course. They can't tolerate fluid. In those instances, I do wonder whether the high sodium is potentially affecting their biochemistry enough that they can't actually tolerate. They're nauseous and sick because of it. Those people tend to respond really well to an intravenous infusion of saline, which then brings their sodium levels down and off they go. But I think they'd be fine anyway. They might just be uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But back to Finn's question, who hopefully has had an answer now, is you don't need to worry if you're a saltier sweater than your mates. You need to still drink to thirst and consume salt to thirst. But you can consider, in small doses, incrementally, explore the possibility that a salt capsule or tablet might change your perception by altering your plasma volume. Because see, this has implications for blood pressure as well. Where is your plasma sitting? In which compartment? In which tissues? And how much of it is there and so forth? So that's where the salt might start to make a little bit of a difference. But there's certainly no reason to panic and say, oh, I'm losing so much salt, I'm in trouble here. Your body will figure out a way to keep it the way it needs to be.
Yeah, it's almost like a badge of honor, I always think, when you see people have done long races and you see the salts on the on the back of a cyclist jersey. You see those in the Tour de France when they have photographers taking pictures. And it kind of, when you see that salt, it's almost like there's the perception of a higher level of effort because the jersey is very sweaty. And when we see that, even in top-level Tour de France riders, you realize that sweating salt is a fairly normal consequence of extended exercise.
Yeah, exactly. It's actually... And this is where the fluid manufacturing, the beverage companies, changed the message, because it should have been seen as a sign that everything's working.
Yeah.
But the way that it was positioned was a sign that there was some failure, which you needed to then correct with a sports drink, which ironically enough would only accelerate that problem, because the addition of a sports drink is actually going to worsen your health prognosis or outcome. So anyway, it was the message always was the body knows best and just listen because it'll tell you what it needs.
You have a beautiful body, Sally G. Exactly. So thanks so much for that question, Finn. And I must say, I thought that would be quite a simple question to answer. But I learned a lot about that. That's very, very fascinating. So the next question we've got is from Adrian Friedman, who says, hi, Ross and Mike. I hope I'm not too late. No, you aren't. Here is my question. It has become fashionable to focus on the 80-20 rule for endurance athletes. Some go even further, Maffetone. Now, Phil Maffetone, I'll give you some context to that, also one of my sort of coaching cycling heroes. For example, he prescribes a heart rate-based formula of 180 minute rage, which would require me to train at 138 beats per minute in all cases, which I cannot contemplate, which I'm assuming means that when you're keeping it that low, you wouldn't be able to walk or even ride a medium-sized hill. Often when these approaches are proposed, it is implied that spending most of one's time in an easy zone is ideal for mitochondrial development, fat adaption, etc., etc. In other words, the implication is that ideal training adaption comes from zone 2 work, combined depending on the program with a small dose of intensity. But is this true? I pay no attention to heart rate or even perceived rates of exertion. I train a high volume, 10 to 14 hours a week. That is high. Made up of running and some biking and an indoor trainer. When I run, I just go outside into the hilly streets of Johannesburg and clock miles without worrying about heart rate. When I ride, I normally choose a program on the trainer road with moderate high intensity, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But some, I mean, basically the question that Adrian's asking is this principle of 80-20. Now, Phil Maffetone, and this is, you can correct me if I'm wrong about this, was the kind of the father of heart rate based training. He was the coach of Mark Allen, who was, I think, a 5 or 6 time winner of the Ironman in Hawaii. And Mark Allen kind of put him on the map because Mark Allen was always finishing 3rd, 4th, and 5th. He went to Phil Maffetone, and Phil Maffetone said to him, do the 180 minus your age. And if you're 180 minus your age, it means you're always aerobic. You're never anaerobic. You can be guaranteed of that, even though everybody's got a varying levels of aerobic, anaerobic threshold. What happened as a result of that is that Mark Allen then went from somebody who was finishing 3rd, 4th, 5th to winning, and winning consistently after Maffetone. So then it became fashionable to really train aerobically. What is the modern thinking, and where are we with this? Because there is so much discussion in this space.
Yeah, so the 80-20 that Adrian refers to is kind of the modern thinking. You can find on YouTube, you'll find clips of Stephen Seiler, who's a very well-known exercise physiologist, an extremely practical guy. Like everything he does is almost asks from the perspective of what's the athlete doing and can I explain it? As opposed to what does my lab knowledge tell me and now I'm going to dictate to the world. So he's very good like that. And he gives a YouTube talk, you've seen it, I know, where he talks about this concept of training at the poles, polarized training, I think he calls it. Is that, I have that right?
Recollection. Yeah, polarized training, yeah. There's no middle, it's either hard or easy.
Yeah, and most of your volume is made up of easy. Now that's not, it's partly because many of the endurance benefits occur in that easier training intensity zone. But it's also a practical reason because you cannot sustain high volumes of training in the high intensity zones because that's where you'll be out there cycling at 300 watts or running at 345 a K, which means that the load on the joints, the impact forces, the metabolic demand, the hormone demand, the nervous system stress is large enough that if we do that for a couple of months, we start to fall off the cliff eventually, go downhill.
Yeah.
So there's practical reasons and theoretical reasons for it. So in order to try and understand this, again, we always try and go back to first concepts, first principles and concepts here. That way you're equipped. It's like teaching you to fish, not giving you a fish. So we have to ask the question, right? Well, when you're training to become an endurance athlete, what are you trying to change inside your body? So in our very first season, we discussed the science of perfect training. And I think many of these concepts came up there. So you might go back and look at that 2019. It was sometime during that year.
Yeah, season one, yeah.
And we basically said that as an endurance athlete, you're going to go out with certain aspirations, whether it's a 3-hour marathon or a 4-hour or a 4-hour cycle tour time, whatever it is in South Africa. And there are 5 or 6 things that are going to stop you. Your cardiovascular system hasn't achieved the necessary capacity to supply blood and therefore oxygen to the muscles. It can't remove the metabolic byproducts of muscle contraction and get fuel to the muscles. There are metabolic constraints. I don't have in my muscles the enzymes that are necessary to turn glucose and fat into energy for my muscles to contract. There's a thermoregulatory constraint. There's a mechanical, or let's call it musculoskeletal constraint. And then there's a nervous system issue. So broadly speaking, those are the systems that training is trying to shift in a direction that will allow you to go a little bit faster, a little bit longer, or a combination of both. Makes sense?
Yep.
So when we talk about, for instance, the first batch there, the cardiovascular, we get those cardiovascular benefits at lower exercise intensities. So the increased blood volume, increased capillaries that are available to carry blood and fuel to the muscles. And Adrian quite correctly alludes to this. He talks about the mitochondrial development, fat adaptation.
Just so give us a quick précis about mitochondria. What do they do and why is it important for endurance?
Mitochondria always make me laugh because
they are funny guys.
Anyone who's ever been in school biology will know mitochondria are the powerhouses of the cell. I reckon that line is written in every textbook in the world on biology ever. That's how they're always referred to. Because the mitochondria is a little factory that sits inside your cell. So if your cell is the neighborhood, the mitochondria is the factory on the corner. And its job is to pump out the ATP.
I love that description.
So ATP is, we've had this one a few times. So
something,
adenosine.
Adenosine. Okay, finish it for me.
Triphosphate.
Phosphate.
That's correct. It. So that's an energy substrate for your muscle. So for your muscles to contract and relax, they require a steady source of ATP molecules.
Okay.
And those ATP molecules are manufactured in the mitochondria, largely. They are also manufactured outside of it, but from a... we'll get there. The mitochondria produce most of your body's ATP as a consequence of fat and carbohydrate oxidation. A very small amount of your ATP is produced from carbs outside the mitochondria. But if you want energy capacity, you need mitochondria. And those little guys are developed as a consequence of low intensity training and high, but you can get an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours a day in Adrian's case of low intensity training, driving that stimulus, keeping that mitochondrial mass nice and high, as well as you would get from high intensity training. So that's why you do it.
So low intensity training, just to summarize that, doesn't necessarily mean that you are getting more mitochondrial benefit or production based compared to a high intensity, because I've always thought that the low intensity was all about how you were going to make more mitochondria and therefore you'd have more endurance ability.
Yeah, that's always been the paradigm, and I believe it to still be true. I've yet to see anyone show per minute of exercise at intensity 1 versus intensity 5, 1 being low, 5 being high, the mitochondrial, the rate of mitochondrial development is higher or lower. I've not seen that. I stand corrected, but I haven't seen that.
But there are other benefits of low intensity exercise beyond just that anyway.
Yeah, plus there's the volume. So it might actually be that you need an hour and you just can't get it from high. There's a paradigm now on high intensity training where they've taken people and done, from memory, one of the studies was literally 10 minutes a day of high intensity training and achieved the same mitochondrial changes as they did from an hour a day of low intensity training. So you can put this thing into hyperdrive and do 10 minutes of high intensity sprint training. A guy called Martin Gibala, G-I-B-A-L-A, was one of the pioneers of that work. And they showed that you can get these adaptations. But generally speaking, the capillarization, the heart and the lung development, and the mitochondria, all of which shifts us to being able to hold an exercise intensity for a long period, happens at low intensities. Now, so then you go, okay, well, what about thermoregulatory? That means how well is your body able to lose heat. That's a function we've just spoken about, sweating, blood flow, the ability to send blood to the skin without compromising the muscle. There's all sorts of adaptations that happen there. Those require practice. Practice makes perfect.
Yeah.
So you won't get those from very low intensity training. You'll only get that from harder high intensity training, preferably in the heat.
Yeah.
Neuromuscular coordination. If your goal is to run 3 minutes 30 or 4 minutes 30 a K, you have to do some training at that intensity. Otherwise, you don't learn the mechanical skill that's required. You might think, well, it's running. What skill
can't
is
there?
Can't
you just do that through aerobic intervals?
But the point is you've got to do some of your training there. So that's why you can't do it all low and long and slow.
Yeah.
You've got to have some on the higher end of the spectrum.
The reason why I ask this is that, I mean, it is very... controversial, and it is a question I've always wanted to know. So Maffetone, his theory around creating speed and ability to run and participate and race at a high level was that he would create aerobic intervals. So that aerobic interval would be 10 by 10 seconds. So in other words, your heart rate wouldn't get up to an anaerobic state, but you'd still be teaching the body to run faster.
Yeah, so that's the neuromuscular adaptation. That's the neuromuscular and the mechanical adaptation.
Yeah. So you're saying that modern thinking is that you still need to have those hard anaerobic sessions to be able to...
And that's always been the thinking. Even the famous proponent of long, slow distance was Arthur Lydiard.
Mm.
And when you read the books, you'll see these 100-mile weeks and they just used to run long and slow. But he also used to do these blocks of really hard interval work where they do 200-meter sprints 10 times, that sort of thing.
Mm.
So even the simplified retelling of an LSD paradigm tends to leave out that they were doing these high intensity things. So the point is that you can't get away with one end or the other. That's where polarized training came from and comes from. Now, with respect to Adrian, we don't know what his heart rate is when he's going out there and he's doing those easy runs through Johannesburg. Or
he says he's 138, so 138, 180 minus What's the difference there?
Well, that's what he says his heart rate would be if he was applying the Mafetone, but he doesn't train with heart rate.
Yeah, I think he's 42.
Well, yes, yeah. If he's, yeah.
Yeah.
So I guess the question he's asking is he wasting time and risking injury and overtraining by probably being higher than 138? And I don't think so. I think the Mafetone thing is a bit too conservative. I can see why it would work for a lot of people. But I reckon that Adrian would be fine going at a subjective effort that he knows that he can sustain. So that subjective effort on his easy days would be 4 or 5 out of 10. On his hard days would be 9 out of 10 for those short intervals. And then once in a while, you need what would be called a threshold session where you are in that, let's call it zone 3, zone 4 for prolonged periods. Yeah, 1 hour. Yeah, that sort of 1 hour tempo runs is what you would call it in the magazine, for instance. FTP type training sessions on the bike, because you have to learn what it feels like as well, independent of just racing. So it's a tricky question because there are so many different ways to achieve the same objective. That's why the concept is what matters, is you have to be applying enough load. So there are people, I mean, 180 minus age would put you at 130. Now, when we go cycling on the road on a Sunday morning and we do our sort of 3 to 4 hours, what is your heart rate?
Oh, I'm riding easy with you.
And it's 115. I'm joking.
It's
below the Mafetone limit.
Well, yeah. So on average, it's below the Mafetone limit. But see, this is my second question. So Mafetone, because he's quoting him, I'm also going to quote him as well, is that he in his book, he wrote about the fact that once you went anaerobic, it was very difficult for your body to go back to aerobic. So in other words, if you were training at a lower level, in other words, you were fat burning in theory, once you went anaerobic, in other words, you now start burning sugar in your blood and the fast-burning fuels, your body wouldn't return to that aerobic state anymore. So in other words, you were losing the benefit of aerobic training as a result of that. So if I'm riding with you and we're riding through town and on flat road and we're sitting at, like for me, 125, I'm still aerobic. But once we hit our first climb and you disappear and I'm trying to chase you, I'm going to be definitely anaerobic for that session. So my overall heart rate for that session might be 127, but my peaks will be in the 150s.
Yeah.
So the question is there any disadvantage in having a overall heart rate that's low versus staying aerobic as opposed to sometimes touching into the anaerobic space?
If there is a disadvantage there, it comes from doing those high intensity things too often and too hard.
Right.
It's not that you compromise on the low side, it's that you overdo the high side. Okay. Because it's not as binary as I'm aerobic now, I'm anaerobic. First of all, it's a spectrum where you don't suddenly shift to not requiring oxygen versus using oxygen. It's not like a switch. I mean, it is a threshold potentially. We've discussed this in our What the FTP episode, but it's not on or off. So what that means is that when you go for those hard efforts, 5 minutes up the last 5 minutes of a climb, and you're well above your threshold, you stop 5 or 6 minutes it might take to get down, but then you will return to a steady state pretty quickly afterwards.
Yeah.
There is such a thing as a post-exercise oxygen consumption where you pay back what you almost borrowed on loan, if you could use that analogy.
Yeah.
But for someone who's fit and adapted like you are, that repayback is fairly quick. So within 5 or 6 minutes of going over the top of the hill and freewheeling down the other side, and you're back to normal. So really, the danger is, if you look back on your training over 5 or 6 weeks, is are you doing those hard efforts too often and too frequently and too hard? That's the problem. Because then you start to hurt yourself as a consequence of this chronic excessive intensity overload. And the mistake that a lot of people do make, and hopefully now Adrian's still listening to this and getting some value, is there is an over-reliance on those hard efforts because we believe that if we want to get better at hard, we have to train hard.
Yeah.
And this is the great paradox, is if you want to get better at those hard efforts, what do you need? You need more mitochondria, more blood, more oxygen, more fuel efficiency. You actually get those benefits training lower and higher.
Yeah.
So the mix is important. But just because you're training low doesn't mean you're wasting your time. And I think a lot of athletes make that error. So they tend to push too hard and their training sort of starts to find its way into the middle because psychologically they think they're getting more value there than on the left of the middle, or you know, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's that gray area.
So you got to stay out of those. So in the absence of measuring heart rate like Adrian's not doing, as long as his perception of effort is comfortable, he's finishing those easy runs feeling like that was easy. I could do that again. If you finish those, what's supposed to be an easy run or an easy cycle, feeling a little bit tired, a little bit hurt, a little bit like, actually, I could have done that a little longer, but that was tough. Eventually, the physiology will catch up to you because your cortisol levels, your sympathetic response, that's your fight or flight, adrenaline levels, hormones, what's happening in the central nervous system is just constantly switched on. And eventually, that becomes unsustainable.
And I guess if you're doing that Sunday ride at a high intensity, and I mean, correct me if I'm wrong on this again, having spoken to a lot of coaches over the years, that the idea that you train easy and hard is that if you train those easy days easy, those high intensity sessions become more valuable. So you're not going into a high intensity session on a Tuesday morning having broken yourself on a Sunday. You've actually got enough recovery to be able to get the most out of that high intensity. But if you get to that high intensity session on the Tuesday after a heavy Sunday ride, you're not going to be able to perform because you're still going to be fatigued.
Correct.
So the professionals, what they do very cleverly, and we've seen this during the season now, when I look at some of the darts of the professionals like Robert Hessink and those kind of guys on Strava, they're riding long, slow miles at a very low heart rate. But there are sections on that course where they're absolutely winded up. And in a total of 200 kilometers on one of Robert Hessink's ride the other day, I think he did about 3 minutes, something along that sort of line, where he was absolutely flat out. But the rest of it, he was literally in zone one and zone two. But it may be an example of just how training easy means that when you train hard, you get the best result.
Correct, because then you see what happens is if you allow your easy rides to move towards the middle, it sucks your hard rides back towards the middle also, and everything starts to aggregate in the middle where you get neither the best benefit nor the recovery.
Yeah.
So that's the long-term issue here is that your zone one becomes a two, two becomes a three. That builds low-level fatigue. This is the kind of like weird, sneaky fatigue that you don't know is there until you push hard. And you say, jeepers, actually, I thought I was good, but my legs just don't have it in me. I feel like I got punctures in my quads.
Yeah.
Because now all of a sudden what was a zone five became a zone four. And your zone four intensities become three. And in the end, everything's clumped around three. So you're getting neither the high-end neuromuscular benefit, nor are you getting the low-end capillarization mitochondria. Because, you see, there are some problems. When you go too hard in those middle intensities, and the process by which our bodies adapt to training is amazing. I mean, if you thought LEG was, like, blown away. Like, when you start to look at a molecular level, what's happening in the muscles to drive these changes. So I can tell you that we make more mitochondria. Think about how there's a signal. And then there's a signal that gets transmitted from one, it's a process called cell signaling. And eventually it turns our DNA, it activates DNA, and then we get, it's unbelievable. Really, I remember studying in biochemistry. It was the most fascinating area I've ever studied. I loved it. If it hadn't been for sport, I would have gone into that world.
Yeah.
But the cell signaling processes can be compromised by excessively high intensity because when the energy density in our cells drops too low, we stop gaining the adaptations that we wanted from a certain training session. So in actual fact, you might block the benefit that you wanted from low intensity by being slightly too high intensity. And that's where it starts to become a problem. And that does sneak up on you. You won't know it until you knew it. And then it might be a week too late and you need a week to recover from it.
And it's interesting because I think, you know, many of us who are relatively amateur cyclists and runners on any kind of sport you participate in, riding with your mates and that sort of thing, it's very hard to necessarily stick in the zones. And we had an experience on Sunday riding a long road ride where we actually joined a couple of top ladies on the route. And one of them disappeared up Chapman's Peak with you. The other one was quite restrained and they were told to do 5 hours easy. When we looked at their Strava afterwards, they'd averaged a pretty low average, but they'd definitely gone into some sections where the one lady who went with us went with you and Richard up the climb really hard. But overall, their effort level was relatively low, except for a couple of sections where they'd gone hard.
And that's what we're saying is the formula here.
Yeah.
Is that when you go out for an easy day, make it an easy day.
Yeah, and I suppose for them it was an easy day, even if it was 5 hours.
Yeah, and reassure yourself that easy day is not a waste of time.
Yeah,
you're not just ticking over to accumulate miles. The junk miles happen when you go a little bit too hard, not too easy.
Yeah.
So you're still getting the capillarization, the mitochondria, the fat burning, the fuel efficiency benefits from those easy days.
And then psychologically, it's nice to be able to just say, hey, today we're just gonna enjoy ourselves and ride 3 or 4 hours, but we're not going to attack every climb.
Right. You know? But then it's interesting because then there's the other psychological coin or other side of the coin, if you wish. And Adrian alludes to that, is if he strictly religiously obeyed the Maffetone principle, he might lose the enjoyment he gets from training.
Yeah.
Because he would be training so slowly that he'd actually stop. Because the sensation of speed, whether you're running or cycling, and speed is relative, by the way, you don't have to be going at Pogacar speeds on a climb.
Yeah.
The sensation of speed is fun. Same thing for running. You don't have to be running 2:45 a k in Eliud Kipchoge. 5:45 a k can feel fast.
Mm.
That's fun. So yeah. I would encourage people to run to effort perception, not heart rate, and to run for enjoyment, but just be very disciplined about easy days must be easy. So if it's effort perception, it's got to be 3 or 4, not 6 or 7. That's not easy anymore.
There's a nice rule that I often think about. If I'm riding on my own or riding with maybe one other person that's on a similar schedule to me, take advantage of the fact that when you can ride easy or run easy, run easy.
Mm.
Because there's always the temptation when you're running with others or on the weekend or whatever to run too hard. So always err on the side of easy, because generally most people exercise probably too hard, particularly on the endurance sports side.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And I think if you're going to make a mistake in response to what we've just said, well, not a mistake, if you're going to take action in response to what we've just said, 95% of you should go easier.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I hate blanket statements, but that one's probably close to landing for most people listening to this.
Yeah.
And not easier all the time. Sometimes you need to go harder.
Yeah.
But most of the time, you probably just need to dial it back one degree, one notch, and just be reassured that that's not a wasted session. Go easier there in order to go harder when you want to. Exactly. Now, I don't know whether that might not be Adrian. It sounds to me like he's got it under control. But try it. Try it and see. Give it 4 to 6 weeks of just making your easier run slightly easier and see what it does when you actually then do go out for a 5K or a 10K time trial or race. When you actually do challenge your physiology off the back of an easier block and see how much better you might feel. And then if you do, you found your formula.
So here's just one additional thing. And I know we don't want to spend too much time on one question alone, but this was an interesting byproduct of aerobic training when I was doing this in my 20s and I was filling the Maffetone schedule. Is because I was basing everything on 180 minus my age, I started to think about form on the run and form on the bike. So I wanted to ride as well as I could at a given heart rate, in other words, a low heart rate. And I found myself getting to a position that when I raced, my form in every respect, from when you're running and you're running at an easy pace, you tend to be more relaxed, you tend to be more focused on how you're striding, how efficient you are. On the bike, it's the same thing. You start thinking about how your pedal stroke's working, are you being efficient, are you pulling through, all that sort of thing. And the result of it is your form starts to improve because you're not focused on killing yourself every time you're going to go and exercise. You're sometimes focused on being as efficient at a given heart rate. So it's almost a byproduct of it. And it was a real byproduct that I really felt made a big difference to me when I was racing triathlon back in my 20s. And that was probably my fittest time purely because of that.
Yeah. Yeah. So I would encourage people to explore lower intensity training.
Yeah.
And as I say, give it a block of 4 to 6 weeks. Use it for what you've just described there, focusing on other things.
Yeah.
Don't neglect the high intensity stuff, but keep them separate as much as possible. And after 4 to 6 weeks, you go and you do your normal 5K parkrun, whatever it might be, wherever in the world you are, depending what you have access to right now. If that in high intensity effort feels better, then you've unlocked a change that you should then stick with. If it doesn't and you want to go back to how you used to train, then nothing ventured, nothing gained. But give it a go.
There you go. Thanks so much, Adrian. That was a great question. We're going to move on to John R. McGibbon, who says, given the impact of mechanical doping in running is now greater than doping through performance-enhancing drugs, with PBs and world records beginning and being meaningless, should WADA, in other words, the World Anti-Doping Association, consider the issue in the absence of meaningful action by World Athletics? Alternatively, if a major World Athletics sponsor developed a PED, a performance-enhancing drug, would athletics turn a similar blind eye? And I suppose what John's trying to say is that the we did a podcast last year on the shoe that broke running, talking particularly about the Nike Alpha Fly.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Should the authorities, should WADA, I mean, mechanical doping, is it real doping? I suppose that's the question.
Yeah.
Should there be some restrictions based on the fact that mechanical doping is assisting running particularly? I suppose it's a moral question in many respects, isn't it?
Yeah, and so John's question is, should WADA get involved here? Because it's quite apparent that World Athletics is not going to do anything about it.
No.
I've got a quote from an interview with Sebastian Coe. He spoke to, I think, Sean Engel or The Guardian, most likely Engel at The Guardian. And I'll share that quote with you in a moment. But the short answer is WADA can't get involved because it's actually a governance issue, not a law rule issue. So all the sports are signatories to WADA. So they've agreed that doping is bad, okay? And they're not going to contravene what WADA then sets out annually, or not necessarily annually, but as a prohibited list. The list is annual. So we're going to test for drugs, XYZ, steroid stimulants, and blood boosting agents. That's different from a regulation that a sport sets up for itself around its own equipment. Now, in my opinion, and this is what we have discussed in the past, athletics has failed to regulate its equipment. And they've allowed technology to distort the meaning of performance to the extent that, as John has said, world records and PBs have become meaningless in comparison to what they meant in 2015. They don't have meaning at all.
Yeah, but the playing fields are now supposedly level because now there are guidelines as to what you can do with the shoe in terms of stack height, et cetera, et cetera. So anybody, any manufacturer can obviously develop a shoe within those guidelines.
Now. Right, and that's what World Athletics is saying we've done to solve this. I don't believe that solves it. It might be that two or three manufacturers can find the same benefit that Nike got within those new parameters, but those parameters are wide enough that I still think that there is enough advantage to be gained that the competitive advantage might not ever go away for the first mover. And I know Jeff Burns, who we've spoken about, is of similar opinion. He's now seen or run or tested three or four of them and has said to me anyway, and I think he shared this on Let's Run, is that he believes that the Alpha Fly remains superior. And then the other problem, and again, I don't want to regurgitate what we spoke about in those two episodes on the shoe, is that when you have a shoe that could give you 4% on average, some people will be getting 7% and some people get 1%. The average between those two is 4%, but there's a 6% difference between a high and a low responder. And so it means that there's now a new variable that determines athleticism in running. Before, you were seeing heart, lungs, and brain, and muscles and tendons. Mm. Now you're seeing all those things plus shoe adaptations or shoe responsiveness. And that's not right to me. So I think athletics has lost a section or a good deal of its validity and performance. Sebastian Coe says he's not worried about it. He says, I'm pretty calm. The specific quote is, I don't think we've reached the point where world records are being handed out like confetti. I don't know, I mean, maybe at his wedding there was a lot more confetti. But if I look back last year, we had 5K track road for men. We had 10K track and road for men. The road 10K went a few times.
Yeah.
The half marathon record has fallen numerous times. And multiple men are running faster by a lot than the old record. Yeah. The marathon record's gone, plus gimmicky under two. The women's marathon record is gone. The half, anyway, they're all gone. Yeah. There's not a survivor.
There's a lot of confetti in there.
So that seems to me like a lot of confetti. Yeah, but anyway, yeah. Then he says, I still marvel at Peter Snell, who ran world records on grass tracts. I don't know why that's relevant. I mean, they were all running on grass tracts. If you were marveling at Snell running them on grass and everyone else was in tartan, then I'd be, okay, this is a good one. So anyway, he says, I'm calm about this, that sports shouldn't interfere with innovation. And Coe's in the middle of two imperatives. One is the imperative to have commercial investment in the sport. And the other is the imperative to have athletic performances mean what athletic performances used to mean. And he's trying to juggle them, and I don't think you can. So anyway, there's as you say, it's a moral and an ethical dilemma.
Yeah.
But WADA can't get involved, not least of all because governance within a sport in its regulations and equipment is a sports issue, not WADA. And the other thing is WADA, I don't think, has the expertise to go in and assess. Because imagine you do it for athletics. Now you've got to go and say, well, should we be looking at tennis rackets?
Yeah.
Some point in the future, the same might happen again in swimming. Golf has seen a revolution. Okay, golf's not a signatory. Although it's at the Olympics now, so it is actually.
Is it? I never knew that.
Was played in Rio for the first time.
Oh, that's true, yes.
Remember, many of them didn't go because
that's
of,
true.
Allegedly because of Zika. So anyway, it would require so much of a restructuring of WADA's purpose that I just don't see it happening.
Yeah.
But I wish that the sport had done what swimming did. You know, they drew a line that was a little bit, drew a box that was much smaller and didn't allow people to play in. But here we are.
So. Yeah. Well, as we've said before in our podcast that we did last year about the shoe that broke running, that kind of the horse is bolted from the stable in this one. And exactly. In many ways, we'll probably look back at this time and say, well, that's when the sport did change. I suppose if the playing fields are level 5 years down the road and all the shoe manufacturers are got a similar shoe that gives a similar benefit, we will just say, well, that was one of those things.
Yeah, because eventually you'll go onto the IAAF's website or these websites that track all-time best performances, and there'll be nothing left prior to 2016.
Yes.
Then it'll be out of sight, out of mind,
yeah.
And nobody will remember when 2:04:18 was a really good marathon because it will be the 733rd best time, and the 732 ahead of it will all be in new shoes.
Yeah.
So the record books will be rewritten so fast that we could shred the old ones and turn them into confetti.
Yeah. Seb. I mean, it's almost happened in a year.
Pretty much. Yeah. That's already what they look like. I mean, the half marathon, and it's nuts. Yeah. If COVID slowed it down. I mean, that's the only reason we're not buried in confetti.
Yeah.
So that will happen. I still got reservations about how large the response might be from one shoe to the next in the same human and what that means. And what it means, for instance, in college athletes who can't get the shoe and who might be 2% better than everyone else and suddenly find themselves 1% worse because they have inferior shoes. And so there's all that little stuff that you'll never see. You know, it's a known unknown. But as you say, the horse is bolted. Now we just have to keep up with a faster horse.
That's why I used to love school days back in the day when you ran on a grass track. Everybody had to run barefoot in our school. We had a nice, beautiful grass track, and the best runner won because there was no mechanical advantage at all. It just had to be how good your muscles were.
Yeah, and that's eventually memories will fade.
Yeah.
And by 2024, we'll be saying the best runner won.
Yeah.
But it'll mean a different thing compared to what it meant in 2014.
Yeah.
But that's going to be the new normal, quote unquote.
It's a good debate. Simon Bo Segard Christiansen, thank you very much for your question. It says, Dear Ross and Mike, thanks for a good program. I thought it would be really exciting that you tackled the topic of occlusion training. When I read this, I thought, I have no idea what occlusion training is. So Ross, enlighten me because I didn't know what it was.
When I read this, I thought, oh man, this is a bad idea asking our listeners questions, because now there's going to be some complicated ones, and this is one of them. It's a really interesting topic. It refers to the practice where you deliberately stop blood flow to a limb and then do weight training on that limb. The idea being that by restricting the blood flow, so occlusion training, occlusion meaning obviously to occlude the blood, is also...
strapping it tight.
So tourniquet or tourniquet, depending on which side of the Atlantic you're on. Cuffs, like blood pressure cuffs. Like you've been for a blood pressure test where they strap a cuff around your upper arm just above the biceps and then they inflate it.
Right.
That's one method.
Right.
And then elastic bands. So you can tie an elastic band around. So there's three ways you can do it: tourniquet, cuff, or an elastic band. So for instance, you would do that right at the upper arm, just under your armpit. And then you would do bicep curls. The theory is that if you are doing occlusion therapy and you lift lighter weights, you get the same benefit as when you lift heavy weights. So we'll go into the reasons for that now. And the reason this is interesting to Simon right now, he says, especially in the light that with gyms closed, not many of us have access to heavyweights, and so occlusion training might be an alternative. So the prevailing wisdom...
Or is it just bull?
That's what he said, yes. That's why he follows us, because he's got a bull sensor. So the prevailing wisdom has always been, and we'll get into some of this in a moment as well, challenging that, is that if you want to build muscle and strength, you have to lift between 60 and 80% of your one rep max. So your one rep max is defined as the maximum weight you could lift in one go. Tricky to measure accurately. You've got to have someone spot you on a bench press, depending on your task. But you're going to fail. That's the point. And the point at which you fail, just below that, is your max. Now we say, all right, your training program will consist of 5 to 8 reps at 75, 80% of that. The occlusion training paradigm is that you can actually lift 20 or 30% of your one rep max, so much lighter. So instead of doing bicep curls with a 20 kilogram dumbbell, I'm now going to do them with an 8 or 9 kilogram dumbbell. But because I've restricted the blood flow to my biceps, I'm going to get the same benefits as I would have got with a heavier weight. That's the premise. So you can see why, if you don't have heavy weights, this is an attractive proposition to you. So why might this work? It has its origins in the 1970s in Japan. It's called Katsu training. And the first papers on it came out in like the late 1990s. So it's relatively, I suppose, in the grand scheme of things, new. The theory is that when you restrict the blood flow, what you are trying to do is you're trying to stop the venous blood from coming back out of the muscle. Make sense? So If I've got my cuff at the top of my arm, the blood in my biceps cannot return to the body. And so you get increased buildup of metabolic byproducts of exercise. So the metabolic strain on the muscle is higher as a consequence of restricting the blood flow. And the trigger that drives muscle strength and muscle hypertrophy is in large part metabolic strain. Make sense? So exactly the same as for endurance training. What we're doing is we're causing metabolic and hormonal disruption or disturbance, and that disruption triggers the pathways that then allow us to adapt. Mm-hmm. What we're trying to do here is the same thing, metabolic strain. So it's hydrogen ions, phosphate, lactate, potentially other things, calcium might be among those. Those are now accumulating in the muscle in greater levels, triggering the cell signaling pathways to cause muscle development and strength and growth that would have occurred with heavier weights, but we've managed to do this with lighter weights. Does that make sense?
It makes sense, but of course my question is there any evidence right. that it works?
So there actually is. Okay. And so since, as I said, it's a relatively new area, so there's not maybe the depth of evidence or the breadth. And as a point of concept, this kind of research shows you the complexity of doing good exercise science stuff. Because imagine you're asking that question, is there evidence that a thing works? You now need to design a study around that. But there are so many moving parts here. So do you take well-trained or untrained people? Mm. Do you make them lift heavy or light? What's the control group look like? How do you do the occlusion? Is it going to be a cuff? Because in the studies...
This is terrifying.
The studies, they describe like 120 millimeters pressure or 240, mm-hmm. or it's an elastic band pulled to a perception of 6 or 7 out of 10 for pain. So there's lots of variability there. What's the training program look like? Yeah. Is it 3 sets of 8? Is it 6 sets of 6? I mean, you've got to put that together. How long is it? Do you do it for a week? We've got to give it 8 weeks. Should it be 4 months? How do you assess it afterwards? Do you assess one rep max? Do you assess fatigue? Do you assess the size of the muscle? If you do size, how do you do the size? Because there's different ways to assess. So anyway, the point I'm trying to make is that when scientists ask a question, does occlusion or blood flow resistance training work? There are lots of different ways to explore the answer to that question. So for that reason, the research is quite difficult to combine. Mm-hmm. But there is a systematic review that came out last year in the American Journal of Sports Medicine. So it's a pretty good journal, published in 2020 by an author whose name is, let me just see here, how's my eyes, Ryan Wortman. And basically they found 21 articles, 21 studies on this. They kicked out the ones that they felt weren't of sufficient quality. You know, it's poor control groups, they didn't describe the people, they didn't describe the training programs, etc. And they were left with 10. Of those 10, 8 showed significantly more muscle development and strength gains than if you had done it without occlusion, and similar to what if you would have got if you'd lifted heavy weights.
Okay.
So that's pretty good. 80% of the studies, the good studies, show a benefit. Three of the studies show performance in sport gets better, and three of the studies show that the size of the muscle improves or increases compared to a control group as well. So on balance...
I feel like we should send out an indemnity form with this podcast.
So that's my concern also, is safety. So yeah. There's another review by Pearson et al. In 2015, which looked specifically at safety concerns. And this other review that I mentioned in 2020 reports that in those 10 studies, which covered from memory about 250 people, not a single side effect was reported. However, that's obviously in a monitored situation in a lab where they're being supervised. Why might there be safety concerns? The main issue by which there might be a safety concern would be...
Your arm could fall off.
Well, if you keep that occlusion for too long, then you've got problems.
Well, I mean, I joke, so, but I mean that's the thing that comes to mind. I mean, you can't indefinitely.
No,
you have to understand how long it takes for your blood flow to stop.
So the rule of thumb would be occlude it while you're training and not while you're not.
Right.
So don't leave the cuff on during the rest period.
Don't sleep with it. Yeah.
But it's really very interesting. So they're reporting very low safety concerns with it.
Sure.
Unless you've got some contraindications, like some vascular issues, hypertension, for example, a risk of clotting and coagulation, then they're saying that you would be advised not to use it. But they're saying in healthy people without such conditions that it is useful. And I mean, there are... So for instance, there's a study that's been done where... And this is not even occlusion, but it illustrates the principle, where they basically did 12 weeks of training, and in some of them they did high load, long rests in between sets, and in others of them they did high load, low rest in between sets. So in other words, they're lifting the same weight. The only difference is how much rest do you get between them. And the group that got less rest got better strength and size gains than the group that got more rest. So what is that?
That's logical, isn't it?
That means, yes. And the point is that rest is when your body is able to clear out those metabolic products of exercise. It's able to restore the hydrogen, the ATP levels, to get rid of the phosphate and the hydrogens and the lactate. If you take that away, you get better gains.
I'm with you.
And that's what occlusion training is trying to do. So that's kind of like an indirect argument for the theory of why this thing works. So the studies that have been done show lactate levels are higher with occlusion training. pH and phosphate levels are higher. You probably, because of the fatigue, because now you've got low oxygen and blood supply to that muscle, the slow twitch muscle fibers need support because they fail. And now you have to start recruiting fast twitch muscle fibers. So normally when you lift 20% of your one rep max, you're only recruiting your slow twitch fibers.
Yeah.
If they fail, now you have to start adding your fast twitch fibers to lift to 20% of one rep max weight. That's going to drive strength gains as well because you're getting more recruitment. So the rule of thumb or the principle is that you want maximal recruitment or as high a recruitment as possible in order to drive the change. And that's what this method is allegedly doing.
Yeah.
And seems to be doing. So it really is quite interesting as a way for people to explore gains in strength without needing to lift heavier weights.
Yeah.
There are other ways to do this, by the way. There are studies, and one of the people who we want to get on this podcast is Stuart Phillips, who's in Canada, and who's led a lot of studies. And as far back as 2010, there was a guy called Bird, B-U-R-D, who authored a paper with Stuart Phillips where they found that if you lift 80% of max compared to 30% of max, you can achieve the same gains in muscle size as long as you go to fatigue both times. Fatigue is the key, not weight. So
yeah.
if you're gonna avoid fatigue, then obviously weight matters. But if you go to fatigue, and that makes sense because the last three or four reps with a low weight and you're maximally fatigued, I mean it's your 30th repetition.
Yeah.
You're going to be recruiting fast twitch fibers because you're tired. The metabolic stress is going to be higher. The mechanical strain is going to be higher, and it's going to drive the same cell signaling processes that you would have got with heavier weights. So, yeah. So Simon's question is interesting because it's out there. Many people wouldn't have
heard
this.
There is evidence it works,
but there's actually evidence that it works.
I mean, I know
there's minimal evidence for risk.
We're not in the game of necessarily advising people the right way to do this, but is there a way of doing this the right way? I imagine that personal trainer would be the right person to do this with, somebody who understands how it works. Even though you're saying the risks are low,
they are potentially supervised studies that have been doing that. And we don't, you know, I find it uncomfortable to think that somebody's going to go and get his wife's hairband tonight and put it on his top arm and then decide to do it, because they could be... Well, he's likely, doesn't sound physiologically like the right thing to do.
Yeah, and in that study by Wortman, I think it was, they talked about the range of pressure. There's a table in that paper, by the way, and this is a free paper, by the way. It's American Journal of Sports Medicine. It's you don't have to be an academic or pay for the article. So anyone who's listening and interested, go have a look. Table one in that paper, I think, has got all the studies, and it actually talks about how they did the occlusion, whether it was an elastic band or a pressure cuff.
Okay.
The pressure cuff is obviously, then you can control exactly how much pressure there is. The elastic band, you're subjective. Mm. I suspect that a lot of times if this method fails, it's because the pressure is not high enough.
Yeah.
So you probably need to have quite high pressure. You need it to be enough, in theory, to stop the venous blood, but without restricting the arterial.
Yeah.
In practice, you probably stop both.
Yeah.
Which means that you don't want to do it for too long, because then you end up getting an ischemic limb, which is not great.
Absolutely.
So the advice would be, do it very cautiously. Don't do your whole session like this the first time you try it. Do one set of your exercises on the biceps or the you can also tie this cuff obviously around your quad and then do squats and leg extensions, that kind of stuff.
Okay.
So do one set, see how it goes. You're likely to incur quite significant muscle damage if you do it for the first time too much. And then you'll know about it, because for 3 or 4 days you'll be walking around like you've been beaten with a baseball bat. So, again, the body will sort of regulate and prevent you from overdoing it. But I think you just have to go into it like excessively cautiously.
Yeah.
And
Carl, I promise that when we put the show notes in this time, we will put a link to that
group of studies.
So, Ross, if you could send me that, we'll put it up on the show notes, because I think it is important for people to research it properly and look at the ways of doing that. And we take no responsibility for arms falling off or limbs dislodging in the next few months.
Just be careful.
Just be careful. But again, be smart.
The papers all conclude that at this point there is minimal safety risk.
Yeah.
Long-term hasn't been studied. So let's be clear about that.
Yeah.
And I want to say foolish use, but aggressive use of occlusion probably is not advised.
Yeah.
Because you want to really do your exercise with it, then release. Do the exercise, then release. You don't want to have a tourniquet around your arm for 45 minutes in your whole session. That would be reckless.
Yeah. Right, let's move on to our next question. That comes from Catherine Hickey, who says, I'm a huge fan of your podcast. Thank you, Catherine. Says, thank you for keeping us knowledgeable and entertained. I'm one of the 40%+ of women who experience menstrual, gynae, reproductive issues and had a hysterectomy at 40. Happily, I'm totally cured and living in a much more comfortable life, etc., etc. I'd love to hear you discuss how the problems women can suffer affect sport and what current research is being done. I coach mainly women and girls, and I have to make modifications to programs for my clients to accommodate a wide variety like PMDD, endometriosis, and menopause. Thank you, from Catherine Hickey. So, I mean, this is a subject that we will definitely have to bring in an expert to discuss in detail. Now, maybe we can just look at some broad strokes sort of research on this, about how the issues that around menstrual cycles affect performance and health and all those things. That's just that Catherine's talking about.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of last year, we committed that we were going to do a series this year on women's health, exercise, and performance specifically.
Yeah.
I think we reiterated that last week, or maybe, I don't recall. But it clearly is an issue that we have to explore. In our first season, when the Mary Kane story hit the news, we did a series with first Trent Stellingworth and his wife, talking about how an elite athlete navigates some of the issues that Catherine has raised. And we did an interview with Amelia Boone, where we try to relate her practical experiences. So Catherine has quite appropriately raised things that we need to discuss. I'm not going to speak for you, but I need someone in here who's really an expert on this field, because I don't think I could do it justice. And it would actually be counterproductive for me to try and read up and then speak about this, because there are people whose life's work is understanding these issues, and they would be far better than I would be. So, unfortunately for Catherine, we're not going to answer that question now, but we are going to commit that we're going to explore this big time. Because the way I see it, there are three things. Number one is that women have menstrual challenges to exercise. So in other words, the menstrual cycle affects performance.
Mm.
it can enhance or worsen depending on the time, one relative to the other. Then exercise in turn affects menstrual function, so it works both ways. And then you get issues, and she's listed some of them, PMDD, endometriosis, and menopause, which are also going to affect exercise as a consequence, a unique set of conditions that men don't have to be worried about, but yeah, women do. So really there are three themes we need to explore. It's exercise on health, health on exercise, and then, for want of a better word, failure of health or challenges to health. So these are massive issues that we need to discuss, but they're issues we need an expert in here, sitting in a third chair,
yeah,
to go through, because there is a lot of research. I felt bad at how unsatisfactory it is, so I did like a little bit of research. There's a really, the best website I was able to find on menstrual dysfunction caused by exercise. And now we're talking about things like REDS that we discussed, yeah, before, is healthforperformance.co.uk. So health and then the number four, performance.co.uk. A lot of resources there, quite good material. I like the look of it. It was pretty good. Yeah. And then there are podcasts as well. Stacey Sims is a researcher who's done a great deal on this. Her podcast, I saw one earlier today, actually. It's called Wild Health Podcast.
Yeah.
In this particular episode, they're talking about fueling and other differences for women athletes. And so these things affect everything, fuel, injury risk.
Yeah.
Many football teams, for instance, are now working on women or female-specific injury rehabilitation programs because it's recognized that the risk of certain injuries is higher in women,
yeah,
than it is in men.
And osteoporosis, isn't it? Well, is more of an issue with women.
Yeah, particularly with menopause.
Yeah. But
ACL injuries are believed to be much more prevalent in women athletes. And so, for instance, football teams are now trying to track menstrual function as a risk factor for ACL injuries.
Yeah.
And again, that's an example. I've seen this. I know that it exists. But I'm out of my depth trying to explain why it exists and how it should be managed. And that's where we need to get someone who does. So, yeah, that's certainly a topic worth exploring.
So yeah, thanks very much, Catherine. And I think we'll be committed to doing maybe not one podcast, maybe a couple of podcasts on this issue. As Ross has said, there's potentially not enough research out there on something that affects 50% of the population. It's quite extraordinary.
Yeah.
So our final question for today, and as I said, we're going to divide this podcast into two. We will do another set of questions from our Patreon members probably a bit late in February. But this one comes from Pete Williams, who says, "Morning, guys. I look forward to an excellent year of Science of Sport content. My question is, how accurate or reliable are estimates of VO2 max on the iPhone exercise and Garmin apps likely to be? My iPhone says that I'm 53.5 and my Garmin says 59.2, which is a significant difference in VO2 measurement." I mean, I'm just going to throw this at you and say it's over to you, Ross, because it's a complex thing, isn't it? Because we don't want to slam too many technologies here.
Yeah, there's computer networks and algorithms here like that I don't think we would believe if we saw people trying to figure out how to estimate this. So VO2 max, for those who don't know, is maximal oxygen consumption, which is typically measured in a lab. You stick a big mask on your face and you breathe in and out through a tube, which then measures the gas that you've breathed in and out, and it works out how much oxygen per minute you are able to consume.
And if you've ever done a VO2 max test, and I've done a couple of them, they are hugely entertaining for those watching, but not so entertaining for those doing, because it is a very hard test, because you basically go to maximum fatigue, don't you?
Yeah, typically they ramp it up. So you start really slow, you fast walk, slow jog, and they get faster and faster and faster and faster until eventually you can't keep pace. So they take you to your maximal performance limit and they measure the oxygen levels consumption at that point. Now, that requires access to a laboratory and specialist equipment, potentially money, which many people don't have access or time for. And so what the technologies are trying to do is estimate that based on what they measure in you when you train. So for example, Garmin is able to measure your speed through GPS and your heart rate through either the wrist or the chest strap. I must be honest, I don't know how Apple does it. I presume that you have to have an app that measures heart rate, otherwise it's a guess. But the principle that they're using, so let's talk Garmin, because I do know a little bit about this one.
Yep.
There is a linear relationship between oxygen consumption and speed or power on a bike, same thing. So if you are running at 4 minutes a K, your oxygen use is X. If you're running at 5 minutes a K, it's Y, and that's lower. So the slower you go, the less oxygen you use, or vice versa. As you speed up, you use more and more oxygen. And that's more or less a linear relationship. So if you imagine in your head, close your eyes, not if you're driving, a graph of oxygen consumption against speed in meters per second, it's going up in a straight line.
Yeah, it's a pretty logical conclusion. Yeah. Yeah.
But the key is that it's linear.
Right.
Okay. So it's because some things in physiology are exponential.
Linear meaning it's a
dead straight line.
Dead straight line. Okay.
Yeah. So if you doubled your speed, you double your oxygen consumption.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting.
More or less. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, no, hang on. It's not necessarily 1-to-1. So Yeah, that's more or less.
In other words, it's not exponential.
No, in fact, it would hold. It would hold. But it's not exponential. Right. It's not like as you go from 3 meters a second to 4 to 5 to 6, it suddenly kicks up and takes off like a COVID case number graph. You've all seen those in the last while. That's exponential growth. So you want to see exponential, look at COVID around the world.
Yeah.
So it's linear. And it's similar enough between people that you can start to compare them to one another. Yes, I say similar, not identical. We know that running economy is relatively narrow between human beings. Mm-hmm. Running economy is how much oxygen you use per kilometer per kilogram. We tested 4 or 5 years ago now a bunch of elite Kenyans. The best of them had running economy of about 175, 180. So that means this guy was using 180 mils per kilogram per kilometer. The average is about 210. And then the less economical people are in the 220 to 230. So clearly when we compare Kenyan to someone who's very uneconomical, there's a big difference. But this, most of the population are around 200 to 210.
Okay.
Does that make
sense?
So
there's a band.
There's a band into which most people would fall.
Right.
Now, what that means is that you can make an assumption. It's not a perfect assumption, but it's an assumption that if someone is running at a speed of, say, 4 meters per second, their oxygen consumption will be X, plus or minus a low range. Okay? Does this make sense?
Yep.
If someone is running at 5 meters per second, their oxygen consumption will fall within a relatively narrow range. And in fact, the slower you go, the tighter this looks. So 5 minutes a K, most people will use more or less 40 mils of oxygen per kilogram per minute.
That's incredible that there is such a similarity.
I'm
quite blown away by that.
Yeah, so the most economical person in the world might be using 35, and the average is 38, 39,
wow.
And the worst is 41, 42.
Okay, so this isn't that far off.
Yeah, so that's the first source of error, is individual differences in economy.
Yeah.
But it's not a massive, it's not like,
but it's not as
it's
bad
not
as
like
you
one
think.
Guy's twofold more than the other.
Right.
Actually,
yeah.
The difference is 4 or 5%.
So it's plausible to think that measurement is reasonably accurate.
That one anyway. So the relationship between oxygen consumption and running speed is reasonably accurate when you infer it across a population.
All right. Yep.
So now, we know that, and by the way, the difference is that if I'm running at 5 minutes a K and Eliud Kipchoge's running at 5 minutes a K, we're using more or less the same oxygen, but his capacity is twice mine.
Yeah.
So my 5 minutes a K and I'm using 35 mils of oxygen per minute, per kilogram, that's 70% of my max.
Yes.
He's only at 50% of his max,
yeah.
Or 45. That's right. The difference, right? But at that speed, our oxygen consumption per kilogram per minute is more. That, you're with
yeah,
me, yeah?
I'm with you. Okay. Yeah, I'm amazed by that.
So that's your first point. The second point and the second thing that Garmin and all these companies are doing is they're saying, right, well, now, in addition to the relationship between oxygen and speed, there's also a relationship between heart rate and speed. So A versus B works, and now A versus C works. So if we know that oxygen and speed tracks, and we know that heart rate speed tracks, we're going to start tracking oxygen and heart rate. So we made a triangle out of this. Makes sense, eh?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
The most basic way of illustrating that is if you're running at your max heart rate, they're assuming you're at your max VO2. And so if we knew your oxygen at any given speed, and now you're at your max heart rate, we're going to assume that that's going to be your oxygen at max, and that's your VO2 max.
Right.
So, but now, most people don't run at their max heart rates. Some will, but not all do. But you're running at 70% of max heart rate, 80%. If you're using the Phil Maffetone method we spoke earlier, you might be at 45% some days.
Yeah.
So what Garmin is then doing is they're gathering all this data. But then you see they have to be very clever because they've got to filter it out. Because when you stop at a traffic light, your running speed is zero and your heart rate's still 145. When you go down a very steep hill, the opposite happens. Your heart rate is low, but your running speed is fast.
Yeah.
When you're going over soft surfaces, they have to take that section out because now you're going to go slower for a higher heart rate. When you go through a tunnel, you lose the heart rate, you lose the GPS signal, yeah. but the heart rate stays. So what Garmin have done, and they describe this in their white paper, is that they've worked out algorithms that cut out sections of bad data. Mm-hmm. And what's left is good data. And then they use that good data to extrapolate what the heart rate oxygen relationship looks like, because they know the oxygen speed relationship and they know the heart rate speed relationship. So yeah. they just basically infer the missing point. So that's what they basically. So the first assumption is oxygen running speed. The second assumption is how they cut out sections, which I think they probably do pretty well. They've got mm-hmm. so much data, they've worked that out. And then the final assumption is what's max heart rate. That's the one that changes the accuracy of their method the most, because they have to assume that your max heart rate is 220 minus your age. That's the formula.
Or
that
have they not been measured the highest heart rate that you have done in the last 6 months?
They could do that, and they do default. I know my Polar does that.
Yeah.
So my age predicted heart rate max is now, well, it's an easy sum now, it's 180. I can regularly get to 200. Yes. So my Polar has replaced my max heart rate of 180 with 200.
But you're one of those outliers which has a relatively high heart rate.
So it's easy to replace it in that direction. It's not easy to replace it the other way.
Yeah.
Because how would, by definition, let's say my max heart rate was 170.
Which is mine.
Yeah, you wouldn't assume that I was running at max unless you told the... So if Garmin wanted to improve this, they could actually ask you to do a session like that. But
to do a session where it gives you a max heart rate.
Designed to give you a measured max heart rate instead of relying on a formula. But
so
I think that becomes quite risky, right? Because now you're going to ask all these people who buy a Garmin, and next thing you're the guy bleeding from his eyes trying to run as fast as possible for 20 minutes. That's not fun for anyone.
Yeah.
So I think they've made a decision that they're going to stick with a max heart rate estimate. And the problem with a max heart rate estimation is that if your actual is higher than your max heart rate, then at any heart rate, you're actually at a lower percentage of max, and they're going to get the wrong oxygen estimate for you, and vice versa. So there's actually a curve where Garmin reckons that the error in their estimate is 5%.
Right, which is acceptable.
But, yeah, it's not too bad. But if your heart rate differs from your actual heart rate max differs from the theoretical heart rate max by 10-15%, that error goes to 9% in either direction. 7% in one and 9% in the other. So does that make sense? So for Pete's question, his Garmin says 59.2. We can probably say plus or minus 5%.
Right.
If his heart rate max is more or less the same as his estimated heart rate max. So he would know that. Pete, you're listening to this. If your max heart rate that you know is more or less the same as what's age predicted, then that 59.2 is 5%, is within 5% of your true value.
Yeah.
If your max heart rate is higher or lower, then that error starts to get a little bit bigger, up to about 9-10%.
And there are ways to do maximum heart rate tests, lots of different things you can look up online if you do want to do that. And it's probably a good thing to do once in a while just to see exactly where you're at.
Mm. If you train as hard as you can sometimes, what you see is your max.
Is your max, There are ways of doing it, finding a 200-meter hill and doing 10 minutes of warm-up and then gunning it for one, all those little things.
Yeah, but over the course of 3-4 months of training, if you regularly put in big efforts, you will have seen a max heart rate on your watch by now.
I know what mine is.
So, exactly. So you just got to be mindful and check it and be aware. In the absence of doing that, age minus your heart rate is probably what first beats and Apple. I suspect they all use the same thing. And then it changes your error. But so in summary then, there's three assumptions. One is that there's a relationship between oxygen and speed, which amazingly enough means that we all use more or less the same oxygen at a given slow speed.
That's incredible.
Second is Garmin makes certain assumptions, not really assumptions, more like calculations, based on when you're standing still, soft sand, downhill, uphill, etc. That might introduce small errors, but probably trivial by comparison. Mm-hmm. And then the third estimate's maximum heart rate. And then all they do is they relate speed and oxygen and heart rate and eventually work out at your max heart rate, this is your speed, therefore this is your oxygen, that's your VO2 max.
Yeah. Well, I'm amazed at that because I thought when I saw this question, I thought, well, it, you know, that these sort of, I mean, I don't want to slag off the technologies, but there's so often that these things are used because they have algorithms based on population sizes and numbers and that sort of thing. But it does sound like it's a reasonable estimate. So
they do, by the way, some companies do also factor in a bunch of other metrics. So what you end up getting is like a regression equation, which includes, and I've told you what I think are the most powerful ones, which is speed and heart rate. Some of the others do use your height, your weight. Sometimes you have to put in there your training history. So they do try and refine it a little bit like that. But I suspect that that's pennies compared to dollars, and the dollars are the heart rates and the speed.
Yeah. I mean, I think, Pete, if you're somebody who's really keen to find out exactly what your real numbers are, I mean, there are, you can do a VO2 test wherever you are in the world. There are lots of places that do these sort of things. So get hold of your local coach or sports science institute or wherever you are, and you'll probably be able to arrange one if you really want to know where it is. Good question. Anyway, that's all from us for this episode. We'll be obviously focusing on some other questions a bit later on in February. We've got some really exciting interviews coming up in the next couple of weeks, and we will share them with you on our social media feed, which is Sports SciPod, and as we do them. But a big thank you again to all of our Patreon members who sent us questions, and a big thank you to Ross Tucker for being with us today as usual. And we look forward to next couple of weeks of some really cool, exciting themes that we will be discussing. But from us, for now, it's goodbye.
Thank you for listening to the Science of Sport podcast. Follow us on Twitter at SportsciPod and on Instagram at Science of Sport podcast.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.